Today on the 21st, there are well more than 100 separate efforts to develop a vaccine for COVID-19. We'll talk to a Chicago researcher about to begin a massive trial for one of them.
It really, from a vaccine point of view, is going at warp speed because we're expected to fully enroll the trial within 7 weeks of starting, and that's unprecedented, frankly.
Then we'll look at the idea of super forecasting, where teams of people have repeatedly made better forecasts than subject matter experts. Then, will there be baseball in 2020? The union representing major league players said no to the league's offer Monday, but MLB says it's going ahead anyway. Meanwhile, a summer college league will play ball in Bloomington Normal. I'm Brian Mackey. That's all coming up today on the 21st, which is a production of Illinois Public Media, airing on WILL in Urbana, WUIS in Springfield, WGLT in Normal, WCBU in Peoria, and WNIJ in DeKalb. But first, the news. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Brian Mackey. Illinois cannot enter the fifth and final phase of its plan to reopen the state on account of the COVID-19 pandemic until a vaccine for the virus is developed. And experts say that could take years. Or will it? There are more than 100 coronavirus vaccines currently in development around the world, and a small number have moved into clinical trials, including here in Illinois. Next month, the University of Illinois Chicago will begin testing a vaccine for the coronavirus. Here to tell us more is Dr. Richard Novak. He's head of the Division of Infectious Diseases at UI Health in Chicago, and he's lead investigator on the clinical trial. Dr. Novak, welcome to the 21st. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks very much for having me.
This vaccine that you'll begin testing next month is different from, say, a flu vaccine, right, where there's some non-active virus in it. I understand that what you're testing actually doesn't contain any coronavirus, but it does help your body develop antibodies. Can you talk about how this vaccine would work?
Sure. Actually, the vaccine contains genetic material of the virus. It's fully synthetic, but it's a genetic material, RNA, that codes for a certain protein on the virus. And so I'm sure everybody's seen pictures or drawings of the virus, and it looks like a sphere with a bunch of spikes on it, or little triangular spikes. And it's those spikes that are of interest because depicts the part of the virus that attaches to the host cells of our body, and allows the virus to get inside the cells. So it's analogous to a key, for example, that unlocks the cell and lets it get inside. And that's what the vaccine is trying to reproduce. It's trying to make that spike protein. So when we inject the vaccine, it's just naked RNA. It's bare genetic material, and it gets taken up by our cells. And it directs the cells to make this protein, the spike protein, and it's shown on the outside of the cells. And the immune system sees that, recognizes that it's a foreign substance, and then starts making antibodies to it. And it's those antibodies that we want so that when there's an actual infection with COVID-19, the virus is trying to get into the body, the antibodies will bind to that spike protein and prevent it from getting in our cells.
So I was trying to think of the analogy here in terms of the lock and the key. I like it. It's basically, instead, it's not quite putting super glue in the lock, but maybe some sort of something in the body that will glom onto the key to prevent it from going into the lock.
Exactly. Okay. That's exactly what it does.
So who is developing this potential vaccine?
So this particular vaccine is being made by a company called Moderna. It's a novel strategy.
And as I understand it, you're going to be conducting phase 3 of a clinical trial for the vaccine. Can you help us understand what that means?
Sure. Clinical research starts with phase 1 studies. There's preclinical, which is developing in the laboratory. Then when they start actually giving it to people, they do first a phase 1 study, which is mainly looking at safety issues, but also in vaccine research, they look at what's called immunogenicity, which means what kind of an immune response is generated and how, is it what we want. So they did a phase 1 study with the Moderna vaccine, And it was, it's usually done a small number of people. There, I think there were 40 people in the phase one study. And it was able to show both safety and immunogenicity. It was immune responses are then measured by taking blood samples and looking at the serum from the blood and the ability of the serum to neutralize the virus in the laboratory. Neutralize means just how we described it, blocks the virus from getting into cells. And so it worked. The vaccine was able to do both those things and did it safely. And so after the phase one study is done, they go on to phase two. And those phase two studies are similar to phase one, in that, but they're in a much larger number of people. Those phase two studies are actually still underway, but because of the urgency of getting a vaccine for COVID-19, the decision was made to move rapidly into phase three. Now, this is being done by a network that has been created by the National Institutes of Health. The Coronavirus Prevention Network is a network that is made up of a conglomeration of all the other networks that are funded by the NIAID, which is National Institutes of Allergy and Infectious Diseases. A phase three trial is a very large trial, which is really focused on efficacy. They want to know if a vaccine works or not. So this particular study is a randomized, double-blinded, controlled trial that's going to be done in 30,000 people throughout the United States, and which is an enormous size study. And not only is it a large study, but it has to be done very rapidly. It's part of what has been dubbed Operation Warp Speed. And it really, from a vaccine point of view, is going at warp speed because we're expected to fully enroll the trial within 7 weeks of starting. And that's unprecedented, frankly. So here in Chicago, we're hoping to enroll 1,000 people into the study. And the enrollment will likely begin in early July. The target date is July 9th, but that's a flexible date that might change.
If you're just tuning in, this is the 21st. I'm Brian Mackey. We're speaking with Dr. Richard Novak, head of the Division of Infectious Diseases at UI Health in Chicago and lead investigator on a clinical trial for a potential vaccine for the novel coronavirus. And a few minutes ago, you mentioned that this is a novel approach for a vaccine by this company. Can you talk a little bit more about what makes it novel and as opposed to, you know, other vaccines that people might be more familiar with?
Sure. There are a variety of strategies for making vaccines. I mean, some of the earliest vaccines were just a piece of protein from the virus, a single protein. You know, proteins are the final thing that the immune system sees. And so first vaccines were just injections of protein. Then other people also tried Early vaccines were just inactivated viruses. They're dead virus, basically. Other strategies, more recent strategies, involve what we call vector vaccines. And those are instances where we take the genetic material of one virus and put it inside of another virus. They're not complete viruses, but they use the shell, basically, of another virus because that particular shell is very effective at getting into our cells, where we want to deliver the genetic material that codes for the proteins we're most interested in that will cause the immune response from the target virus, which in this case would be COVID-19 or coronavirus. So those are more traditional routes of virus development. There are also what we call attenuated viruses, where they take the actual virus, but they pass it in the laboratory multiple times until it becomes somewhat weakened. And they use that as the vaccine. The measles virus, for example, is one of those. And we have a number of other examples of attenuated virus that work that way. Polio virus, the live polio vaccine, works that way.
Getting back to this particular trial for the vaccine, you mentioned 1,000 patients. Who are these people, and how will you know if it's successful?
So this vaccine is aimed at primarily people who are most likely to get sick from the infection. And those are people over the age of 65 or people who have some underlying chronic illness such as diabetes, high blood pressure, chronic lung disease or heart disease. We already know from the pandemic and the cases of people who've gotten sick that they usually fall into those groups. And so we're going to target those people primarily for the vaccine, because the study endpoint for the vaccine is, in this case, is symptomatic illness. We want to know how many people get physically ill from the disease and whether or not the vaccine prevents that, rather than just preventing infection. It would be great, and I imagine some people will have complete prevention of infection, but the most important thing is that we prevent symptomatic disease. And so we need people in the study who will have symptomatic disease if they get sick. The way these vaccine trials work is that half the people will get the vaccine and the other half will get a placebo. It's double blinded, which means that neither the investigators nor the participants will know what they're getting. And at some time points along the way, as the trial moves forward, an unblinded group of scientists will look at the data, and what they're looking for is to see if there are fewer infections or fewer symptomatic infections in the placebo, in the vaccine arm rather than the placebo arm. So that would be a sign that the vaccine is having an effect, as opposed to if everybody had the same number of infections in both arms, it would indicate the vaccine wasn't doing anything.
As we mentioned at the top of the show, developing a vaccine usually takes years. I wonder, why does it typically take so long? And I mean, you mentioned that the process is being expedited for COVID-19. Can you talk about that aspect of this trial?
Yes. So the reason that vaccine trials take long is because it takes a while to find an effective vaccine, but you also have to have a certain number of cases of the disease in order to be able to reach a conclusion about whether or not the vaccine is working. Now, in the case of COVID-19, we're coming through a period where we've had a huge number of cases, and now it's starting to fall off, particularly here in Illinois. As planned, if we start the study in July and there aren't a lot of active infections going on, it may take a while to accrue enough infections to be able to say anything about the effect of the vaccine. Now, if things do accelerate again in the fall, as many people are predicting, then we'll start to see a lot more cases and we'll be able to reach study endpoints a lot quicker. So worst case scenario, this trial is designed to go on for 2 years, but it could go to the full 2 years before we have an answer. However, if we do have an increase in the number of cases, we could get an answer as early as even December. It's really a function of how many cases there are in the population.
Interesting. So I want to remind our listeners that we have a new initiative here at the 21st. It's called Text the 21st, and you can join by texting the word TALK to 217-803-0730. That's TALK to 217-803-0730. And a few weeks ago in our texting group, we asked listeners the question, with Illinois in phase 3 of reopening, are you engaging in your normal activities and how are you keeping yourself safe? And we got a response from a listener who said, not yet. Quote, I'm retired and vulnerable for health reasons. I will not resume normal activities until there is a vaccine, end quote. So, Doctor, you mentioned that, I mean, it could be as early as December. It could take the full 2 years of the trial. I wonder, not just this trial, but, I mean, do you have a gut instinct as to how close you think we might be for getting a vaccine from the sort of testing phase to where it's actually available from a drugstore or doctor's office for widespread use?
Well, I wish I could tell you for sure what was going to happen, but I guess I just don't know. My experience having done vaccine trials for so many years is that it's just not safe to predict. But I'm very hopeful that this vaccine will work. One thing I can tell you is that the reason there are so many participants in this study is because there's tremendous interest in getting an answer quickly. And so if you enroll 30,000 people, you're going to get a lot more study endpoints in a short period of time than if we enrolled only 1,000 people. And also, this is only the first of a series of vaccines that are going to be tested in a short period of time. The plan is to move forward very quickly with a series of vaccine trials. This will be the first, beginning in July, but there'll be another one in August, another in September, another in October, and another in November, and possibly another in December. So, and there are all these very large studies that are being done very rapidly. So even if this vaccine is not it, maybe one of the subsequent ones are, or maybe we'll have something that is partially effective early on and then later find something that's more effective. Or maybe we'll just hit the jackpot and this first one will be it. We can only hope.
We can only hope. So if people want to volunteer to participate in this clinical trial, is that something they can do? And if so, how can they sign up?
They certainly can. It would be best for people in the Chicago area because this is where we're testing it. They can access our email address. It's projectwish@uic.edu. Or they can call our phone number. Project Wish, by the way, is our clinical research site. And the phone number is 312-413-5897.
And we will put both that address and the phone number on our website, and we'll also tweet it out on our Twitter page, which is 21st Show, 21st Show, if people weren't able to get that down while they're maybe driving around right now. So Dr. Richard Novak is the head of infectious diseases at UI Health in Chicago and the lead investigator on an upcoming clinical trial for a potential coronavirus vaccine. Dr. Novak, thank you so much for taking the time to speak with us, and good luck with the trial.
Thank you so much.
As ever, we'd love to hear your thoughts about what we talked about on the show today. Send us an email to talk@21stshow.org. That's talk@21stshow.org. We'd love to hear from you. More to come after a short break. This is The 21st. Stay with us. Welcome back to The 21st. I'm Brian Mackey. The term super forecaster may sound a little bit like magic or something involving tarot cards and a crystal ball, but super forecasting is actually rooted in science, taking a global network of people making predictions about the future based on research, frequently with more accuracy than individual experts in specialized fields. Recently, super forecasters have applied their skills to making predictions about COVID-19, like when we might see a vaccine and potential pandemic scenarios for the fall. We're joined now by Warren Hatch, the CEO of Good Judgment, Inc., a company that spots, trains, and works with super forecasters to come up with predictions about the future. Warren, welcome to The 21st.
Thank you for having me today.
I'd also like to welcome an Illinois-based super forecaster, Brian Hartman. He teaches computer science in Monticello in the central part of Illinois. He's also part of Good Judgment's global network of super forecasters. Brian, welcome to The 21st.
Happy to be here.
And also joining us is another Midwest super forecaster, Chuck Harper, a retired toy store owner from South Bend, Indiana. Chuck, thank you for being here as well.
Thank you for having me.
And we want to invite our listeners, if you have a question about super forecasting, maybe you've read the book Super Forecasting and you might want to try your hand at this someday, you have a question for our guests, you can always join our conversation by giving us a call at 800-222-9455. That's 800-222-9455. Warren, I'd like to begin with you. We gave a brief description in the introduction here, but what exactly is a super forecaster?
Hi. Well, I should also say that while not technically a Midwesterner, I did live in Minnesota for some time, so I still have visitation rights. and thanks again. So a super forecaster is one of the individuals who are the top performers in forecasting, and The forecasting that we do is with probabilities. So we think probabilistically, what is the probability that a vaccine will be in wide distribution by the end of the year? So Anthony Fauci says likely and things like that. We'll use probabilities, numbers. We're going to say, in our view, it's the probability is in low single digits, around perhaps 10%. And the super forecasters assign those probability estimates with very high accuracy. They were originally identified in a U.S. government research project that was tasked with doing exactly that. The U.S. intelligence agencies wanted to improve their own forecasting skills. So that's what this research project was about. And the super forecasters, many of them, including the folk, my fellow colleagues on the line here, came over for the commercial company where we're doing work with clients. And the now the super forecasters are identified and trained over on our public forecasting site, Good Judgment Open. And we'll regularly go there and invite the top 1% or so to come and join the professionals.
And that's something where anybody can join. And we can talk a little bit about that later. But, you know, I wonder, before we get too much into that, maybe it'd be helpful for listeners to understand what super forecasting is not and what it's in reaction to. And I wonder if you can just talk briefly about the difference between what you're trying to do and, say, the pundits that people might see on cable television news talking about U.S. politics, for example.
Yes. So the dominant language of forecasting is still what we see so much on TV and the Sunday morning shows, where it's very vague. And it is words like likely. So a vaccine is likely, or this candidate is probably going to win. And what that does is it does a few things that are really not good for discourse. One is, what does that mean? What does likely mean? What I think that is might be different from what you think it is, or we may even have different views tomorrow versus today. The other thing is that words like that can be on either side of really 50%, either side of maybe. If there's a vaccine, I'd say, well, I said it would be likely. And if there is not a vaccine, it's, well, you know, I only said likely. So there's no accountability for it. And the last thing is that there's no way to keep to communicate in a shared language. So if we're thinking about a vaccine being available, or if we're thinking about the airports reopening, or we're thinking about schools reopening, it's so much more clear and beneficial to use a shared language like probability so that we can understand exactly what the path of recovery is going to be looking like. And the last thing too is that these numbers provide feedback. And that's the real important part of becoming very skilled at forecasting in this way, is knowing when you say 80% probability of something occurring, over 10 instances, it'll occur 8 times and it won't occur 2 times. That means you're a very well-calibrated forecaster. And if you have that track record, then others can have confidence in the probability that you provide, that that's meaningful, just the way we do with the weather forecasters, right? So years ago, weather forecasters pioneered this approach and use the same kind of feedback mechanism that we use. And very good weather forecasters, they say 80% chance of rain, we're going to find out next weekend whether there's rain or not, and we can have high confidence in their forecast as a result. We want to be doing the same thing in public discourse.
If you're just tuning in, this is The 21st. I'm Brian Mackey, and we're talking about super forecasting. And I want to remind our listeners, you can join the conversation at 800-222-9455. That's 800-222-9455. You can also tweet us at 21st Show, 21st Show. Brian Hartman, I want to bring you into the conversation now. You're a computer science teacher by day, but also a super forecaster. How did you get into this?
I was in the research that IARPA and UPenn were doing long ago, 6 or 7 years ago, and I found out I performed in the top 1%, and they flew me out to a conference in San Francisco, and I've been on board ever since.
I mean, how did you even get into that initial research group, though, I wonder?
I think I saw a link on an economics blog, as that was my undergraduate degree.
Okay.
And it seemed like something fun to do with some free time before I had kids. I got started that way.
All right. And Chuck, Chuck Harper, you're based in Indiana. I wonder, how did you get into super forecasting?
It was written about by David Brooks in the New York Times, and that was my first notice of it. And there were links there, and I went to the site and signed up, and started up the third season that they were going out of four. And that season, somehow I got to be named a super forecaster.
Interesting. David Brooks, one of those people that super forecasters are trying to kind of push against, I guess, in that sort of punditry mode. I wonder, to the extent you can talk about it, and maybe Brian, I'll start with you. In early February, Good Judgment predicted there would be between 100,000 and 200,000 COVID-19 cases reported by March 20th. The world hit the 200,000 mark just one day earlier. So, I mean, that was a pretty accurate forecast. I wonder, what are some of the other things now that you all are working on related to the pandemic?
We're working on, very fittingly, when the Major League Baseball season will open, which has had a ton of interest recently.
Oh, yeah. Stay tuned. We're talking about that in the next segment on our show today.
Exactly, so. Right? I'm pretty excited for that. We've talked about when New York City schools will open, UCLA passenger traffic at some airports, and then world cases, world deaths, United States cases, United States deaths. That's some of the COVID-related ones that I've personally been working on. There's other ones out there, but those are the ones I'm most familiar with.
Sure. And Chuck, what about you? Are there similar things you're working on? Anything different than that?
Certainly looking at the COVID, I'm kind of intrigued by what's been happening recently with the divergence between the increasing infections and yet the death rates continue to decline. I think at some point that's probably going to be a big story. There's just a lot there we don't understand.
Interesting. So, Warren, I wonder if you can walk us through the process of developing a super forecast. I mean, maybe you can give us an example of a prediction or, again, and I don't even know if you like the term prediction. You can enlighten me on that. But a prediction that Good Judgment has made recently and how you went about it from, you know, developing the question to coming up with a forecast.
Sure. And some people will have very specific definitions for these things. Like some people will think of a prediction as something Nostradamus does, where it's an absolute certainty. This is my prediction. It will occur. And that's not what we do unless we have a forecast of 100%. But whatever the words are, the main idea is that we're going to use probabilities when we think about an uncertain future. We're quantifying the hunches we have about what might be happening. That's the main feature. And so what we'll do when we work with a client, whoever they might be, is try and understand the decision they're trying to make. So in the case of some of the COVID work we've done, if you're involved in the hospitality business, then knowing when the amusement parks would be opening is very consequential if you're in that supply chain or working in that business. And so we worked with a client on coming up with a testable proposition, a question where we can all agree what it is we're forecasting and that we can all agree come the day whether it occurred or did not. And so in this case, we said, well, what's the probability that Magic Kingdom will reopen? It's a very closed space. When will it reopen to the public? And we actually launched that question about a week before Disney had their earnings call. And the CEO was asked the question, well, when are you going to be reopening North American parks? And he goes, well, I don't know. I don't have any forecast for that. Wish we had been able to join him on his call or send him a quick note, because Brian and Chuck and our colleagues had a very high probability that they'd reopen before the end of the second quarter. And that's what we've seen here. So the main thing is we want to connect to decisions. We want it to be meaningful. We want it to be clear and transparent what's going on and what it is we're forecasting. And then above all, we want to be keeping score of what our track record is.
And I gather that's one of the keys here is that it's sort of verifiable that these are things that you can then go back and check on the numbers, check on the results to see if these things pan out. Brian, a recent Time Magazine article about super forecaster to mention that one of the skills of a super forecaster is humility, reflectiveness, some comfort with numbers. I wonder if you feel there's, you know, something about your personality that lends itself to this hobby of super forecasting. You know, I don't know, maybe a certain Midwestern humility, not to be too essentialist about it.
Yeah, I think being able to admit when you're wrong is a key personality trait to have. If someone brings me data and says, you know, I know you've always thought this about yourself or this situation, but here's the data I have, here's the reasoning behind it. I've just always been willing to say, you're right, I'm wrong. I mean, that also makes for a happy marriage as well. So I think some of it is personality based, yeah.
Do you get family members asking you to make forecasts? You know, should I marry this guy, or, you know, what stock should I buy, or anything like that?
Not exactly. There was some stuff. We had a Disney trip planned for spring break, and when one of the pundits made the news rounds that Disney wouldn't be open until 2021, I had some people talk to me about that. But other than that, again, Midwestern humility, I try not to go around telling everyone what I'm up to.
You know, and Chuck, I wonder about you. If they're, you know, do you get that reaction from people when they find out that you're into this? And beyond that, I wonder if there are any, you know, getting beyond the humility, if we can for a moment, are there any sort of forecasts you've made that you're particularly proud of, that, you know, that were on point?
Boy, that's a tough question. We've made quite a few. I would say just kind of adding on to what Brian said, I think one of the worst mistakes you can make is to invest your ego in your position, because it makes it very difficult to change, and you want to be free of that so that as new data comes in, you can change your mind. Now, that would be, I guess, my advice. I don't know how much of that humility is Midwestern, but that would be my advice.
Yeah. Well, we've got just a couple of minutes left. And Warren, I want to wrap with a question from you. Earlier in our show today, we heard from a doctor who is leading a clinical trial for a potential vaccine for COVID-19. And I wonder if Good Judgment has any predictions about when a vaccine, or forecasts about when a vaccine might be available.
We do. And the specific question we have asks when an FDA-approved vaccine will be made available to inoculate at least 25 million people and distributed around the United States. So it's a very clear line we're aiming for. This isn't just a vaccine being announced. It's produced, distributed, and administered. And the probabilities that we have right now are distributed across different ranges of time. So we have a very low probability that that's going to occur before October. That's our first bin. The probability that it might occur in between October and March of next year is a little higher, 13%. And that's been edging up. The real story, though, in this particular forecast is the following time ranges, which is April to September, and then September to the following March, where the probabilities that we see such a vaccine widely distributed have been moving much higher. When the question opened, there was a pretty widespread skepticism among the super forecasters that we'd see that before 2 years' time. And what they're doing too, this is really an important part of good forecasting, is you look to historical examples. So How long does it typically take for a vaccine to be developed, produced, and distributed? It takes a long time. And headlines aside, there's still all that must be done. Now there's all these accelerated programs that are going on. And so we're seeing that in their improved outlook for about a year from now. And it's edging up a little bit for early next year.
All right, and we're going to have to leave it there, unfortunately. Warren Hatch is the CEO of Good Judgment, Inc., and we will have a link to Good Judgment open if you would like to join our other guests, Brian Hartman and Chuck Harper, who are both super forecasters. If you would like to try your hand at this process, you can go to that. We'll have it on our Twitter page, 21ST Show. Thank you all so much for joining us. More to come after a short break. Stay with us. Welcome back to the 21st. I'm Brian Mackey. The question on the minds of baseball fans is, will we be hearing play ball this summer? Major League Baseball and the Players Union could not come to an agreement on terms to restart play. That just happened Monday afternoon, but MLB plans to begin a 60-game season in late July. Anyway, we'll look at what a Major League Baseball season might look like and some other Illinois-related stories around the league, and then we'll shift to other leagues, where right here in Illinois, the newly formed KCL, or Colonel Collegiate League, plans to begin play in Bloomington Normal with fans in the seats on July 1st. In a few minutes, we'll talk to Todd Coons, general manager of the Normal Corn Belters Collegiate team, who is instrumental in forming and organizing the four-team league in the midst of a global pandemic. That'll be in a little while from now. But first, joining us from the Chicago Tribune is the Cubs beat reporter Mark Gonzalez. Hi, Mark. Welcome to the 21st.
Hi. Thanks for having me on your show.
And listeners, our phone lines are open if you want to join this conversation today. How do you feel about the return of baseball this summer? Would you be willing to go watch games in person? Give us a call. The number is 800-222-9455. That's 800-222-9455. Or you can tweet us at 21st Show. So, Mark, MLB and the Players Union had back and forth negotiations about a possible return to play for months, couldn't reach an agreement. What were the points of contention, and what does it mean for a potential MLB season now?
Well, I think from the Major League Baseball Players Association, they wanted to play more games at prorated pay, and they kept getting dragged on with proposals by Major League Baseball to play games, but at less than a prorated schedule. So right then, there was a gulf there for a while, and then the Major League Baseball also wanted to add a few things. The final things that need to be concluded are the health and safety protocols, and that's been a source of scrutiny for a long time. Is this how you go enforcing these, and how safe are the players really going to feel? Where are they going to stay? What assures them of giving them the best chance at staying healthy and not contracting the virus? A lot of steps there. But the main issue is, are the games played and at what rate? And the players have been firm from day one. They want to be paid at their prorated schedule.
Yeah, and we can leave a different radio program to talk about, you know, the designated hitter rule negotiations and the advertising on the sports uniforms, which I thought was interesting. I saw that in your article. How does the MLB plan to address social distancing restrictions with players and fans and other aspects of, you know, that we've come to expect with baseball?
Well, Mayor Lightfoot made it clear yesterday that there'll be no fans initially at the ballpark. Just, you know, we're not in that phase yet in Chicago, at least from the standpoint of large crowds yet. So fans probably will be relegated to buying a steep ticket on the rooftop if it's open. And I'm sure those rooftop seats might be available as long as they're enforcing social distancing. But in regards to the players and the uniform personnel, I think there's some models you can look to. One is what they're doing in Korea, umpires wearing masks. There's been some cases of social distancing in the dugouts. I talked to one coach that's in Korea about 2 months ago, and he was telling me that players are checked before they get inside the ballpark with temperature. And then they have apps on their phones to show when there might be some people who have the coronavirus and areas to stay away from and all that. But I think there'll be some safety guards that players will have to get used to. But I think it's very important they do this, but it's probably going to take at least throughout their shortened training before they start playing games.
Okay. You know, I want to talk about some other baseball issues related to Illinois. You've written about Cubs president Theo Epstein's recent self-criticism of his hiring practices, which was prompted by the national conversation on racial inequality and recent protests. And I wonder, what was his big realization, and what is he vowing to change?
He went for a bike ride one weekend, and he saw one of the demonstrations, and he was just really amazed at the people involved, mainly people of all ages, races, age, and that it was peaceful. And he thought that it was very impactful. And I think he took a step back, looked at himself, looked at his methods, and figured, I got to change. And looking at the makeup of his front office, which has been very successful, but you look at a lot of the backgrounds, or they're a lot like him, Ivy League backgrounds, maybe not heavily involved in playing the game itself, with few exceptions, and the issue of a racial background came up. So he's taken a step back. He's going to evaluate his situation. He's got a very loyal cabinet there, but I'm sure if there was a staff member or two to leave, he'd probably address it in that way.
Interesting. And, another baseball story that's been making news a little bit is a new documentary that came out called Long Gone Summer, about the historic 1998 home run race between Cubs slugger Sammy Sosa, St. Louis Cardinals Mark McGwire. Illinois, of course, has a lot of Cubs and Sox fans in Chicago. But once you start getting into, central and southern Illinois, it's St. Louis Cardinals territory. I wonder if you can just sort of talk about what you remember about that home run race in 98.
It really took on a life of its own. And it really, I think, to a point, overshadowed the fact that the Cubs made the playoffs that year as a wild card team, but I think it really healed baseball, especially, 3 years removed from the work stoppage, and the fact that the Cubs had a legit power hitter to rally around in Sammy Sosa, and down in St. Louis was Mark McGwire as well. I remember, and I worked in San Francisco Bay Area at the time covering the Giants, but I just remember all the national writers going the cover of McGwire and Sosa's home run chase, and just how it really took over a pretty fascinating wild card race. But the attention it garnered was fascinating. And you really hadn't seen that in a while, two guys going at it at that feverish pace. But it really captured the minds of a lot of fans who were passionate about baseball, and some who were kind of on the fence, and I think they got reeled in pretty quickly.
But of course, we look back differently on that now today, don't we? Given what we know about drug or steroid use in the league at that time.
Yeah, and I think McGwire fessing up 12 years later kind of confirmed a lot of people's suspicions, and then on the other side, you have Sammy, who's really danced around the subject, and still wants to be embraced. And I still don't see a reunion between him and the Cubs for quite some time.
All right. Well, we're going to leave it there. Mark Gonzalez is the Cubs beat reporter for the Chicago Tribune. Mark, thanks so much for joining us today. Really appreciate it.
Thank you. Have a good day.
You too. And listeners, if you're just tuning in, this is the 21st, and we're going to shift now from the major leagues to some Illinois-based minor leagues. While you may not be able to see a Cubs, White Sox, or Cardinals game in person this season, beginning on July 1st, you can go see the normal Corn Belters play the Bloomington Bobcats in the KCL, which is the Colonel Collegiate League, at Corn Crib Stadium. It's very on-brand in the naming. Joining us now is the general manager of the normal Corn Belters, who was instrumental in the formation of this new four-team league. Hello to Todd Koons. Welcome to the 21st. Thanks for being on with us.
Hey, thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
So, Todd, the normal Corn Belters usually play in the Prospect League, but when the season was canceled, you helped start the Kernel League. So how did this all come together?
Well, I think it happened very quickly, and I mean in almost 24-hour period. And I want to give people the true credit that's deserved for getting this rolling is, you know, Mike Brown with the Bloomington Bobcats, and Matt Stembridge, who's the president of baseball operations and part of the ownership group, sat down and it just was amazing all of the talent that was available because of all the collegiate baseball players' seasons being canceled. The talent pool was there. And so once they did some, just sent out some feelers on what it would take, it just came together in a couple of days. And so we were able to form four teams. Mike and Matt were able to form four teams, which are the Bobcats, the Corn Belters, the Gems, and the Hoots. And they have nothing to do with obviously the Prospect League, but just were able to form these four teams with solid rosters of collegiate talent that from the local area. So all these players are from the Central Illinois area, and even though they may go to other major Division I colleges, these are all area talent and great talent, and was able to fill those rosters really quickly.
And all of whom who had their collegiate seasons cut short, if they even got underway at all. I don't actually know exactly when the collegiate season starts. I'm sure they were training, if not playing.
Yeah, they were really lost, cut short, and never got to play. Some of the seniors, which is really difficult for them, the seniors lost their season. And so, you know, at the local level, these players, like, we'll have players on these rosters from that go to Michigan, Indiana, Tulane. We've got six Bradley players, Louisville, Indiana State. For Illinois, you know, we've got Illinois State players, Eastern Illinois, Western Illinois, Cal State, Northridge. So, again, just can't reemphasize the talent level that comes from this market that allowed us to play some, you know, some significant collegiate wood bat baseball right here in Central Illinois.
Mm-hmm. So how has fan interest been in the league so far? I mean, Corn Crib Stadium has a 7,000 seat capacity. We just heard a moment ago that at least in Chicago, there's not going to be any fans for Major League Baseball if that season gets underway, at least to start. Is there going to be fan attendance at these games? Will there be enough room for social distancing? How's that going to work?
Yeah, I think following all the state, county, local guidelines and direction, we've been in contact with the, you know, consulting the health department, McLean County Health Department, and the city and the state. We'll follow all guidelines, which are going to shift again on Friday with stage four being announced. But we'll have all of the precautions, and they're even posted on our website, you know, cornbeltersbaseball.com, and then you click kernels and you'll see the guidelines that we have that we'll follow. But, you know, all of the details as far as social distancing, the stickers will be placed on seating, the concession stands with the guards, the plexiglass guards will be in play. We have a huge berm lawn area out in our stadium here that can hold a large amount of social distanced fans. And so our concession stands, the you know, hand sanitation, the social distancing, the mask, all of those things will be in play. And mm-hmm. And I think that it's been a remarkable journey to get you know, those things accomplished, let people come outside and enjoy. The fan response has been incredible. People, the phones have been lighting up, the online orders are lighting up. Everybody's excited just to be able to come out, social distance, be safe, but also get outside and see some baseball.
All right. We're going to have to leave it there for today. We've been talking with Todd Koons, general manager of the Normal Corn Belters collegiate baseball team, and where they're going to be playing in Corn Crib Stadium. Earlier, we heard Mark Gonzalez, Cubs beat writer for the Chicago Tribune. Thank you to Todd for joining us today. Appreciate you coming on the show.
Appreciate it. Thank you.
All right. Before we go, that is all the time we have for today. But before we go, I want to make a pitch for joining our texting group. We've been hearing interesting things from listeners. It's informing our coverage. You can join it by texting the word TALK to 217-803-0730. Again, send the word TALK to 217-803-0730. You can find more information about that and everything else we're working on at our website, 21stshow.org, where you can also subscribe to our podcast through 21stshow.org. You can also find us on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, and NPR One. Just search for The 21st. Our program is produced by Libby Foster, Anna Casey, and Ryan Wild. Eunice Alpasan's our engagement producer, and our intern is Zainab Qureshi. Technical direction and engineering comes from Jason Croft and Steve Mork. Reginald Hardwick is our news director. Thank you to the band Public Access for our theme music. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. I'm Brian Mackey.